Okay, everyone, welcome back. I hope you had a good session on planning for International Night, huh? That's one of my favorite times of the year is International Night because, well, yeah, it highlights so many good things we try to emphasize here at the college. Did you have any, before we get into Ruth in this session, again, I'm following Old Testament preaching on Ruth. Did you have any questions, anything that related to Judges? Went through 21 chapters pretty quickly. But, yeah.
Why didn't Joshua have a succession plan? Yeah.
Why didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it was Moses and Joshua.
Why didn't Joshua have a succession plan? I guess you'd have to ask Joshua. But it is true. I mean, it draws a blank, doesn't it? You say the assistant to Moses was Joshua. The assistant to Joshua was?
Caleb
was older than him, you know. The correct answer to the assistant to Joshua was, is a dumb look. Huh. That's the correct answer. Because there isn't any one person that comes to mind. Here's the question, though. Should there be? I mean, is it God's plan that we have a single leader, leading his people? It certainly was the case for Moses, and it certainly was for Joshua. But is that this is a leadership question that I think each of us needs to ask and answer. I remember when I was in my pastoral internship, you make plans to be under this pastor to mentor you and all that. The pastor that was mentoring me was the one who married my wife and me, you know, and he was in California. We were over in Texas. We made all these plans, you know, to come and meet, for me to get mentored by him over the summer. And then 2 weeks before I started my pastoral internship, he resigned from the church. And then I was mentored by guys younger than me, you know. Who are also associate? I really weren't. It was just a sort of a trinity of three guys looking at each other, not knowing what in the world to do, you know. And I went to the pastor and I said, before he left, he had already resigned, and I said, why are you leaving? He said, because God's plan is for the church to have a single leader, and the church won't accept me as the single leader. And I began thinking about that. Is that God's plan? He specifically said, Moses was a leader, and Joshua was a leader, and then they didn't have a single leader after that, and look at all the problems of the book of Exodus. But I was wondering then, and I'm still wondering now, are we talking about something that is a divinely ordained pattern here? Are we interpreting Scripture correctly to do that? What we do find is all the way back to Exodus 3 are elders. If you're looking for a consistent plan, Sutita, is that what you're going to say?
Yeah.
Go ahead, say it.
Yeah,
say
sorry.
It.
I mean, like, even Moses, they have some helper from each tribe that help him to, like,
very good.
On really smart.
Moses had a lot of helpers.
Yeah.
In fact, you can point to other passages. We didn't talk about Exodus 18, for example. Moses got criticized by Jethro. You know, his father-in-law, why are you trying to handle all this yourself? You just cannot do this. So if you're looking for scriptural support, I mean, you can point out to different passages, it was way too much for Moses. And so God, you know, and even when Moses was up on Mount Sinai, God said, I would put my spirit on the 70 elders as well. You know, in fact, I don't know if you've thought about it, but the whole system of the judicial system that we, I don't know if the U.S. is the one who started it, but the U.S. pattern of having lower courts handle the simple problems and move on up to district courts, move on up to federal courts, and finally all the way up to the Supreme Court, that whole system is all designed based on Exodus 18. That you don't have the single court or single individual be the one who makes all the decisions. So I wouldn't argue for the period of the judges being a problem because they didn't have a single leader. Although, as we saw, when you get to the last verse of Judges, it says it did not have a king. I don't personally interpret that as being you need to have the single leader who is the king, because we know that the single godless king can lead the people into idolatry as well. We'll see that as we get into the Book of Kings and Chronicles. The king has to have a singular authority himself, which of course is the word of God. So I would take Joshua 1:8 as more of the overall principle. Do not let this book of the law depart from your mouth. You know, be talking about the law. Be focused on the word of God. And in fact, one of my concerns about my own church that I'm pastoring is there's too much trust in me. We have a unified church. It's a wonderful, wonderful body. But they could let me get away with too many things. And I keep saying, no, I need more other leaders to join with me. And the Lord's been really faithful after some years of too much being put on me to bring others into it. In fact, today, in an hour and a half, my fellow pastor is going down to immigration because his employment pass was approved. So I'm not going to argue for a single leader. Because today itself is a day where I really rejoice to see that the Lord has allowed this process. So I have others join with me in leadership. And there's about four of us now in the church, three or four of us, who are providing leadership for the body, which is to me a wonderful thing. I really don't want the leadership to be focused on me. It's too much to handle. Plus, then there's no accountability. So I've told my associate pastors, I've told them, I'm grateful to have you because my wife and I used to have the elder meetings. We just lay in bed like this and pray together. Our elder meetings are just praying to God, like God, like this. Accountable to her, but we should be accountable to others besides our spouse, I think. So I don't know. That's really a great question. But anyway, any other thoughts about that? That's very good in relationship to how to bridge from Judges into Samuel. Okay, let's move on into Ruth. We'll have a few minutes in Ruth. This is a story that's familiar to all of us. But what is the message of the book? I'm entitling the sermon on this in terms of applying, be relational. Here I differ from some others that have a different idea as to what the main teaching of the book is. Perhaps you've heard that saying, God helps those who help themselves. Right? You've heard that, right? And is that in the Bible? It's 2 Heresies 4:7. You know? The real verse, or the real idea, I think, biblically speaking, is not God helps those who help themselves, but God who helps those who help others. And how do I apply the book of Ruth? Let me just ask you to apply it to yourself. You know, you've made several decisions already today, right? Since you got out of bed this morning. Have you made those decisions based on what's good for you or good for others? Why did you choose the ways you chose to get to the college today? Why did you choose how to use your time? You know, it's almost noon. The day's almost half over. Have you lived for yourself? Have you lived for others? Have you been concerned about your other classmates? Did they get their homework done? Are you concerned about them? Were their issues with their family is... do you want to turn next to you and turn and ask if the other one next to you got their homework done? No, I don't mean to do that. But now that one is in the Bible. That's in the Bible. Having this concern to work together for others. And I think the theme of Ruth is God rewards the selfless. That's not to say there's not theological teaching in this book, but I'm trying to show how the book of Ruth actually applies to us. Of course, the theology of the book applies to us as well, especially what is said about the kinsman redeemer, how God would provide one who would, especially a man who would help provide for the women. And this time, women's protection was found within their fathers or their husbands in their lives, because they didn't have the kinds of opportunities that they have today. This is what I see in the book. God rewards the selfless. Everything Ruth does in this book is for others. You know, think about Ruth. What does she do for others? Help me out here. How do you see this idea of selflessness in Ruth? Starting from chapter 1. She left her own country. Most of us don't leave our own country. There's a sense of selflessness to leave your own country. I'm not going to elaborate on this. Then you'll think I'm complimenting myself because I left my country, you know. But I didn't leave my country for my sake. There are a lot of people who come to Singapore because Singapore, they can make a whole lot more money coming in Singapore. I came to Singapore because I can make a whole lot less money coming to Singapore. You know, then I, no, I'm kidding, but why do we make the decisions that we make? Oftentimes when I talk to people and they find out that, you know, we've lived here for a while, you know what people normally say? What? You've been in Singapore 28 years? You must really like it. And in my more bolder moments, I'll respond back, your assumption is that I'm here in Singapore because of me, what I like. And then if I say it like that, people go, oh, well, sorry, I didn't mean to say that, you know. But the assumption is you go and do what you want to do because that's what you like. We all assume that. Do what you want to do. And sometimes I'll respond back and I'll say, well, your assumption is that I'm in Singapore because I like Singapore, but actually I find Singapore too hot, too fast, hard to develop relationships in. There are things I don't like about Singapore. And then I'll also respond, there's also things I don't like about the United States. You know, too independent, people don't think about other people. Too concerned about, you know, their own comfort and their own... You know, there's things. I hope you as you grow in the Lord Jesus, you've become more objective about your country. I hope for those of you Singaporeans, the majority of you, that you look around, that you see the others in the class, and you hold them in high esteem, the ones who are not from Singapore. You should gain that. You should gain that while you're here. Because these other ones, the non-Singaporeans in this class and in your other classes, I mean, you Singaporeans, I love you guys too, but the non-Singaporeans, I mean, it is not easy to leave their country and come here. I've been in correspondence with a student to come next year from Nepal, and that's very complex for him to bring his wife and two children here. And he keeps asking me, can I get my children in school? And I say, well, $1,000 a month for your kids to be in school. Like, wow, it's a big deal to try to come, especially as a student, and be here. But all this challenges us in terms of, do we live for ourselves or do we live for others? We know that the period of Judges was a time when everyone just lived for themselves. But does everybody have to do that? Book of Ruth says to us, no, you don't have to live that way. So you see, the book of Ruth began with the phrase, in the time when the judges ruled. That's a very, very important phrase. Because the sentence before it, the last verse of Judges, says, everybody's doing what they want to do. And then Ruth comes, you turn the page, Ruth comes, and here's a lady who doesn't do just what she wants to do. In fact, she's willing to leave her own country and go to... the land of Israel, for whom? It's so that she can get married and she can establish herself and all that. I mean, think about it. Ruth's been married for 10 years to a man whose name is Sickly, okay? Mount Malan means sickly. That's what the... Now, ladies, would you marry a man named Sickly? But she's willing to marry him, and then she's married for 10 years, and she doesn't have any kids. Humanly speaking, what kind of prospects does Ruth have going to the land of Israel and an Israelite wanting to marry her? Men, if you wanted to have children, would you marry a widow who's had plenty of opportunities to have children for the last 10 years and she's not bore a child? If you want to be a father, humanly speaking, she's not the right one to marry. I'm saying this to say that Ruth is she's willing to move to help care for Naomi in her old age. She's doing it all from a selfless concern. And actually, Boaz is doing this from a selfless concern as well. You know, Boaz says later on, oh, you could have gone, Boaz could have gone for some of the younger women, because Ruth obviously wasn't among the youngest ones. She'd been married for 10 years. So why marry someone who's maybe 30 years old and barren when you can marry someone 20 years old, probably has a lot more potential to have children? So you see Boaz actually responding in a very selfless way as well. You can live the selfless life in the midst of a selfish world, I think is the message of Ruth. And God rewards that. God rewards that. So I'm taking the word rewards, making that as really the key word for the book of Ruth. What was our key word for Judges? Failure. Maybe these are not contradictory, failure versus reward. You'd think of rewarded versus not rewarded. But the failure of Judges leads to just anarchy. The selflessness of Ruth leads to rewards. And I think the question that it raises is, how does God reward us when we care for others? He does. He does reward us. If you want to live a life of joy, here's my advice to you. Don't live for you. You live for you. You live for all your preferences, all your whatever you want, you're not going to experience joy. Joy is outside of you. It's focusing outside of you, and then it comes back. You care for others, and then it comes back to you. And that's really what we see in this particular one. And the context is, in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. And so we see that Ruth is actually taking place at this time. Just to review the last part of Judges, the failure of Israel ends, and the end of Judges with this Levite pagan priest blessing Dan's ungodly migration up to the north, and then the Benjamites murder a concubine so that other tribes nearly destroy the time of the tribe of Benjamin. And then now we have actually a third illustration of what was happening in the period of Judges, except now we have a positive illustration. So you could think of the book of Ruth as appended to Judges 21. Let's just add another four chapters to it. But as one scholar, my teacher, Dr. John Reed, said, the book of Ruth gleams like a beautiful pearl against a jet black background. You know, pearls are beautiful. But if you put pearls on a white background, it doesn't really... You're not going to sell that many pearls. If you go into the jeweler and he wants to show you a beautiful pearl or a diamond, what does he do? Yeah, he always puts the black velvet background to it. And so Dr. Reed says, yeah, that's what the book of Ruth is like. You have that black background of the period of Judges. And then Ruth herself, and also Boaz, and honestly, just about everybody in the book is honorable. There's a couple things that kind of go by real quickly. They're not so honorable. Naomi comes back and she says, don't call me Naomi. You know, Naomi means pleasant. They say, call me Mara, bitter. But you know what? That's the last time you hear the word Mara in the book. Everyone else says, no, we're not calling you bitter. We're going to call you Naomi, because we're going to see that, we're going to help you see that God has an actual purpose in all this. So perhaps Samuel saw the need to balance the negative picture of the judges with godly examples like Ruth and Boaz, who lived by the law of God despite their national unfaithfulness. And so, as I have on occasion here, one of the key theme of Ruth is similar to that of Judges, God's redemption. But here's the difference. In Judges, we have redemption through deliverers. God keeps raising up these many, many judges to deliver the people. But now we have in Ruth redemption through a godly couple. So God's working in families to accomplish his purpose. And this is actually my own personal testimony. It wasn't through a person that I came to know the Lord Jesus. It was through a family, a godly family, seeing how the mother and the father responded to in ways that I had never seen before as a 13-year-old. And God used that to help me to see, wow, I really want what this couple has. I guess I'm going to need to have their God if I'm going to have their type of marriage someday. So there's lots of contrast between Judges and Ruth. Instead of faithlessness, we have faithfulness. Instead of immorality, we have fidelity, righteousness, and purity. Instead of idolatry in Judges, you have following the true God. Everybody in the book of Ruth says, the Lord bless you, you know. Boaz goes and greets the harvesters, the Lord bless you. And the harvesters kind of look up from the, you know, from the work. Oh, the Lord bless you, Boaz. Like, I mean, how many of your workers do that? You know, blessing their boss, and he's blessing them. It's just a wonderful, wonderful picture here of people working. It's not just Ruth and Boaz who are seeking to honor the Lord. You have the people of Bethlehem that are saying, we don't want to live like the rest of the people of Israel. Let's, after all, Bethlehem means house of bread. Look at what God has done. God's provided the bread for us. And let's thank him for it. So how does God reward us when we care for others? I take it that what we've got in the book are a couple ways. One of them is God meets our own needs. This is really what we've got in the first couple chapters. Do you think the Lord will take care of your needs if you go and your focus is on others? I don't know how it's going to happen, but it's going to happen in my life, all right? 29 years ago, my wife and I, we sold our home in the U.S. to come here. So we haven't had a home 29 years. Most of our friends have a 30-year lease on their, you know, payments on their home. So all of, pretty much our family, our friends, everybody's paid off their home by now. And we have to still make our first house payment. I've been talking to Susan. Yeah, let's go back to America for a few months next year. Maybe buy a home. And she says, yeah. She's used to me, you know, throwing out these sort of things, I guess. And I say, God meets our own needs. He has all the way up to this point. And she believes that. My wife believes that. In case you're wondering how we've survived here in Singapore all these years, credit my wife, Susan. She's an amazing, amazing lady. Some of you know her. You know, without her, I think I would have left a long time ago. But God does meet our own needs. He has done that in my life. And he will do it in the days to come. The ones who preceded me, other missionaries come to Singapore, and they're back home in the States. The Lord's taking care of them. And you'll see it. Watch my Facebook posts 20 years from now, if I'm still here, you know, on earth. And I'll just be telling you how the Lord's been faithful to me in my 80s, as much as he has been in my 60s. So it's really quite a beautiful story. Let me just give you some of the bigger pictures here, and then we'll have to close it down on Ruth. Slide 23. I think the key verse of the book is the most beautiful depiction you'll find of trusting the Lord in the Old Testament. A salvation statement from someone who wasn't part of Israel. Because Ruth says to her mother-in-law, when her mother-in-law says, go serve your gods, basically. Go back to your people and your gods. Ruth says, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people, the Israelites, you know, will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. You ever heard of anyone making a commitment like that? You've seen it in marriage, right? And many of you have made that commitment in marriage. I will stay with you till death. And I made that commitment to my wife, but I did not make it to my mother-in-law. I didn't say, where you go, I will go. Where you die, I will die, you know? This is an amazing statement. And she, especially since she's saying, I'm leaving all my Canaanite deities and I'm following your God. This is a beautiful, beautiful statement. It's holistic. It's not just me as an individual, I'm going to do this, but it's, I'm going to be part of your corporate people. And this is a wonderful declaration we find in the Old Testament of how God accepts those who are non-Israelites to be part of that community. So don't let people convince you that, oh, God's just a God of the Jews. He's not. He invited any of the peoples of the nations who wanted to join with his people Israel. There was no real ceremony to do this for women. But for men, it was circumcision. The men that wanted to be part of Israel would do that. In fact, this is part of the theory of where baptism actually came into being during the intertestamental period. I need to study this more to find out the roots of baptism. But we have John the Baptist baptizing people. We have some forms of baptism in the intertestamental period. The theory is that women would come and they would self-immerse when they would be identifying with Israel from pagan nations. An interesting thing to think about, but I need to study that more and find out whether that is really the case or not. So that is the essential message of the book of Ruth. And there's wonderful, let me share with you one of the wonderful things that Boaz says to Ruth when it's kind of like she proposes to him. You know, I mean, she says, I'm available if you want to redeem me. Boaz's response in Ruth 2:12 is, may you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. So God is depicted here as a bird. And if you look carefully at this picture, you'll see that under the wings of this bird are two little chicks. The word here is kanaf. May you be, you know, God has his kanaf, his wings. And you've come under God's wings. You've come under God's care. And you know, he's not going to disappoint you. He's going to care for you. Okay? So that's, may you be richly rewarded. Now I'm going to jump on over to slide 65. You know what you find? Ruth, the next chapter, that was chapter 2 when Boaz is talking to her about, you know, gleaning. And Boaz says, may God answer your prayer that, you know, you've come under God's wings. May he provide for you. The next chapter, Ruth quotes the same word that Boaz uses when she does her I'm available, you know, speech. I'm your servant Ruth, she says to Boaz, spread the corner of your garment over me since you are a kinsman redeemer. You don't see it in the English, but she's actually using the word kanaf here as well. In Hebrew, the word for wing is the same as the word for a corner of a garment. You can see the similarity between them, right? The corner of your garment is like that. And so she uses the exact same word that Boaz used. If I was going to paraphrase it, it'd be like Ruth saying, do you remember chapter 2, you prayed that God would, put me under his wings? Well, you know, God has uses humans for wings too, and you have a wing right there on the garment. Would you just kind of put over my legs as a symbol of the fact that you'll take me as wife and you'll answer your own prayer? Have you ever answered your own prayer? Boaz was basically answering his own prayer here. God uses the same word in Ezekiel 16 when God says, I spread the corner of my garment over you, kanaf. Isn't that a beautiful picture of how the Lord takes care of us? Maybe it really communicates well to you ladies, but it should communicate to us men as well. Because God wants to use, he wants to use even us men, to provide some level of security for our wives. Well, as you know, the story ends with baby Obed. My wife's been teaching Ruth lately, and she brought out something I had never seen before. Tell me, I wonder if you've ever noticed this in Ruth 4. So Boaz took Ruth, she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive. 10 years of not having any kids, and whoop, all of a sudden she can have kids. And she gave birth to a son. Ruth 4:14. The women said to Naomi, not to Ruth, Naomi, praise be to the Lord who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. Which raises a question. Well, oh, okay. Naomi has a kinsman redeemer. Who's that? What would be your normal response? Who's that kinsman redeemer? It's Boaz, right? That's what we're thinking. But let's read on. May he become famous throughout Israel. Well, that could apply to Boaz. He will renew your strength and sustain you in your old age. Is Boaz going to sustain her in her old age? For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and is better to you than 7 sons, has given him birth. It seems to me that he's saying this little baby that's born is really going to be the one who's going to sustain you in your old age. He's your kinsman redeemer, and Boaz is as well. So basically, the book ends. I remember in my earlier years of reading Ruth, I thought, you mean the whole thing ends with a genealogy? Oh, what a boring end. Really? Genealogy? That's what puts everybody to sleep. So I'd always kind of end the book, Naomi has a son, verse 17. But then it says, and then they named him Obed, and he was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So we actually have the word David is the very last verse of the book. You learn when you get to the last verse of the book, this whole story. This is about David's great-grandpa, Boaz. It's about the birth of David's grandpa. You should have a aha moment when you get to the end and say, wow, I never knew it. And to be, interestingly, this is actually paired with what we have in the last couple chapters of Judges. In Judges 18, remember that really gross story about this idolatrous priest and all that, and he led the Danites away from the Lord. When you get to the end of Judges 18, the Danites built the town. There they set up idols. And look at verse Judges 18:30. There the Danites set up for themselves the idols, and Jonathan, catch this, son of Gershom, son of Moses, became their priest. He went, and his sons were the priests for the tribe of Dan until the time of the captivity of the land. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of years later. This false religion that the Danites had in the northernmost city of Israel, that was founded by Moses' grandson. And you don't know it till you get to the end of the Judges 18, to the end of the account. Well, we have a parallel account. There's this righteous Boaz and Ruth, and they have a son, and you don't know that this son is actually the grandpa of David until you get to the last verse as well. So we'll pair these together. The grandpas can have a huge impact on their grandkids. You know? And grandpas' grandsons often don't follow the faith of their grandfather. Jonathan certainly didn't follow the faith of his grandfather Moses. Are you kidding? He led the people, he led this tribe away into idolatry. So here's a lesson for us. God doesn't have any grandkids. You know, every one of us needs to make an individual commitment to Him. And I asked how many of you are from Christian families, and half of you said yes. Half of you raised your hand. That really causes my heart to rejoice. And I pray that it would go down to the third generation, you know, if God so wills to give you children. So how does God reward us when we care for others? I would say that God helps those who help others. And He ends up providing like a kinsman redeemer, really, is what we find in this book. He meets our own needs. We see this in Ruth 1 and 2. But what we see in Ruth 3 and 4 is that God sometimes rewards us more than we ever dreamed. More than we ever dreamed. You know, Ruth went back to the land of Bethlehem just to make sure that Naomi she had enough food. She never, ever dreamed she would be in the Messianic line. And this is an exciting thing for me to think about. As I serve the Lord could potentially do things in me that I never dreamed of. I could go on and share with you some of them. But here's one of them. I never dreamed of having a website of Bible teaching materials in 49 languages. When I thought about coming to SBC some 30 years ago, I never dreamed that I could have an impact on seminaries in Africa from SBC. But there's actually seminaries in Africa that go and access a website and use these sort of things. I never dreamed that I could teach people in Saudi Arabia how to preach. But there's a group in Saudi Arabia that access the website, the how to preach section. And they taught a whole class based on what I had there and taught all these people preaching. So they all, in their underground groups, end up sharing the gospel. Those are some things that I've seen the Lord do that I never dreamed of. And you know, the same thing applies to you. You follow the Lord and there will be a sense of reward that God will give to you. So what does the Lord want you to do about what you've heard? I mean, how can you, He's going to do His work through you. But here's the basic idea. Do you live for yourself or do you live for others? May I encourage you to live for others. And as I say in the book, be relational. So which person in your world is God telling you to help? How does the Lord want you to help others in your own sphere of influence? What does it look like today for you? Today, how can you impact other people? How can you live the selfless life and then end up with the kind of joy that Ruth experienced in the midst of utter tragedy in her life? How God would take her and exalt her in such a wonderful way. And Boaz too, you know. Without Ruth, you never would have heard of Boaz, right? But through this whole thing, God ended up putting Boaz in that messianic line too. And we learn from these people, you don't have to lower your standards down to so you're like everybody else. God can use you and me to raise up and hold His standards. Be different from the rest. And I commend you for doing that. I believe you want to do that. That's why you're here at this college. If you want to just live like everybody else, you'd be going to a national university or something like that and making two or three times the salary than you'll be able to make. So I you all know that. So I commend you for your... I'm talking to the Singaporeans here, but I'm so thankful for those of you who are not from Singapore as well, that the Lord has opened the door for you to come here and be part of our the family here, so that He can use you in ways you've never dreamed. All right, any thoughts from you or questions about Ruth?
You said that the book is about Naomi as much as it is about Ruth. Starts with her and her family ends with Naomi.
Naomi, you think we've maybe have named the book incorrectly? It should be named Naomi because she's the main character instead of naming it Ruth. I don't know who named Ruth, the Jewish tradition way back, but it is very much about Naomi. It begins with Naomi not having any kids. She has two sons. You're sure you're going to be a grandma if you've got two sons, right? But her husband dies, both her sons die. And then not only is she a grandma when we get to the end of the book, but she's a grandma who's a grandfather of David. So yeah, the Lord certainly honors her. She struggles, but she's willing to go back to her people. She doesn't stay in Moab just languishing and dying in depression. She's willing to get up and go back. She's actually willing to get up and go back by herself, not having her daughters-in-law. She doesn't say, oh, I need some protection. I need my daughters-in-law to come. She says, no, I want what's best for you. You guys, you ladies, go back to your people. I think that's what's best for you. She doesn't realize that what's best for them, for Ruth, is for Ruth to come to her. So there's a mutual blessing there in their lives. So Naomi is it is beautiful at the end. And all the ladies say, Naomi has a son. Like, Naomi has a son. I wonder if Ruth overheard that, you know. What do you mean, Naomi has a son? You know, I mean, if Ruth didn't have the right character, she'd say that. What do you mean, Naomi has a son? I'm the one who just went through all this labor and everything. It's a similar thing that happens at the end of chapter 1. Because Naomi comes back with Ruth, okay? And they go, oh, she looks so bad. Can this really be Naomi? Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, because Almighty's been bitter, you know, with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. You know, she's saying that publicly to the ladies, and Ruth's standing next to her. I'd love to see the expression on Ruth's face. You came back empty. What am I, chip beef, you know? You came back empty? Am I just empty? You know? I've been talking to you the whole time. I just made a commitment to stay with you till you die. She didn't come back empty. I mean, that was her view of life. But yeah, she doesn't ever again in the book ever say, now remember, I told you to call me Mara. Stop calling me Naomi. I'm in depression. You should call me my depressive term. She doesn't ever rebuke people from what we, I don't want to, I'm reading it between the lines, I know. But yeah, that's well taken. Other thoughts about Ruth? Excuse me. Of course, the book is pointing to Jesus, is it not? Because it's pointing to David, and we know that David is the ancestor of Jesus. And the whole story takes place in Bethlehem. So by the time we get to Matthew chapter 2, we see the Messiah is born in Bethlehem. We should have this kind of background. We should realize, wow. Look what God has done to this obscure little town of Bethlehem. And I'll point that out as we get into Samuel in the next session in terms of how the Lord kind of really pulls all that together. Yes?
Quite ironic that through Naomi's family's disobedience that Ruth came in? Because you're not supposed to intermarry, right?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. Did they intermarry? I guess you would say yes, they did. But was God going to be accepting of what is intermarriage anyway? I guess it's raising that question. Is intermarriage marrying someone who is outside the line of Israel, or is intermarriage really an issue of marrying someone who worships other gods? In the case of Orpah, it looks like Orpah just, she went back to serving her gods, you know, and her people. So I would say, yeah, that would be the wrong kind of intermarriage. But I don't know what Ruth was like prior to that, for those 10 years of her marriage. Was she saying, I really want to follow the God there? And then she just reaffirms it in Ruth 1:16? I don't know. But certainly the New Testament looks back on Ruth in a very positive way. And the book of Ruth itself depicts Ruth in a very positive way. So it's not ungodly intermarriage in the sense of bringing pagan idolatry into Israel. Far from it. It's more the idea of Israel reaching out and bringing in those whom God had touched. It's sort of like Rahab too. You know, Joshua 2 is not presented in a negative way at all. Or Joshua 6, when they conquer Jericho, they save Rahab. And they say, yes, come on in to the family of Israel and be part of what God is doing here. So it's looked at in a very different sense than what we see with Solomon marrying these pagan women who follow all their pagan gods. So it's very different. Yeah. Yes.
So the whole book of Ruth is actually the redemption of Naomi's family. So it started off with Naomi's family fleeing from Bethlehem.
It's a redemption of Naomi's family. Yes, yeah, it is.
In the sense that it was kind of a sin, because I'm not sure. Because as I was reading about unlawful migration, is that counted as unlawful migration from Naomi's family?
Oh, that's a good question. Did they do the wrong thing by leaving Bethlehem when it was under famine in the first chapter? Did God? And then some would say, yeah, they did. And then God punished Naomi by taking the three men in her life because she was sinning against the Lord. I'm not sure I would go there in that, but that might be arguing too much. She's trying to get food. Of course, the rest of people in Bethlehem, they did remain, right? And Naomi left. And they remembered Naomi from 10 years earlier, or more than that, you know?
The word is settled.
When she, the word is settled? Settled as opposed to...
just relief from the famine.
Yeah. You know, Abraham did the same thing. Was Abraham dishonoring God to do that? Were the sons of Jacob dishonoring God to go down to Egypt during the famine? I don't think it was their intent to live the rest of their lives outside. You see that when Abraham is in Egypt and his wife dies. Look at Genesis 23. What does he do? He brings her all the way back to Israel, buys a cave for her, and buries her there. I mean, he's not saying, I have left Israel, I don't think God's promise is going to be fulfilled. He's actually saying the opposite. He's saying God is going to bring my descendants to this land. I guess I'm saying Abraham doesn't bring Sarah back to Ur, I guess would be the way to say it. A similar idea would be Joseph says in Genesis 50, don't bury me here in Egypt. You can put me in a coffin and all that kind of stuff. Keep me here temporarily. But when you guys leave, I want you bringing my bones back to the land of Israel. So you can visit it today in Hebron. You get the cave of Machpelah is a place where we see Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their wives all buried in the same place. So even though they lived a good portion of their lives outside of Israel, their heart was still toward Israel, and God is going to bring us back there. So they saw that more as a temporary thing, and they knew that the Lord was going to fulfill his promise. Yes? Okay.
So Obed was considered the son of Naomi's son. Is that correct?
The son of the kinsman redeemer would act in a also in a selfless way, because his son would be in the name of his brother.
He would be considered part of the lineage.
Yeah. The idea of the kinsman redeemer was to selflessly marry a woman who did not have a son and hopefully have a son through her. And then that son would be actually in the name of the Yeah, Naomi's son. Is it Mahlon or is it Kilian? Anyway, I think it says in chapter 4. Mahlon's widow, Ruth 4:10. So he says, Boaz says in Ruth 4:10, I've also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among the family or from the town records. So he's saying, yes, I'm taking Ruth as my wife, and the son that she has, we're going to have her. I mean, he will be born officially, legally, as Mahlon's son. And yet the narrative actually, that was his desire, but from God's perspective, God says, no, biologically, Boaz is really the father.
But because in Matthew, the genealogy goes back to Boaz.
Yeah, you don't see Mahlon's name in Matthew 1 or Luke 3. Yeah, so sort of like God is saying, I know your heart, and I know the customs here, but I'm gonna have you be really the kinsman redeemer. And actually, Obed is the kinsman redeemer as well. He's the one who gives new life to Naomi. It's a beautiful picture. It's very much a beautiful picture of what the Lord does for us. I have a whole section here on the whole idea of kinsman redeemer. There has to be a need. There has to be a redeemer. I'm on slide 98. Who's related by blood, who's willing to redeem, and who's able to redeem. That's all exactly what Jesus did for us. Jesus made the payment, and we just simply accept that. That whole kinsman redeemer idea makes its way into John 3:16 and all the various sort of passages we have in the New Testament that tells us that Jesus actually is our redeemer, and the redemption is through the cross. Well, all that goes back to Obed. All right, great questions. We need to stop at this point so we can move on to Samuel. So thank you.